12:09 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Good afternoon. This is John Williams. You have 12:09 on a relatively, I suppose, a slow market day, or not. Elise Glink joins us now to talk a little bit about what's going on here. Elise, of course, is the real estate and financial wellness expert. She's the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves, the author of also 100 Questions Every First-Time Home Buyer Should Ask. Visit thinkglink.com for more about that. Elise, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, John. Nice to be here, but I'm not so sure it's such a slow day on Wall Street.
You know,
the markets are up quite a bit.
I was thinking of something else when I said that and thought, no, shut up, John. It's not that at all. In fact, what's going on? Where we have seen as many as 400 points on the upside on the Dow. What's that all about?
Yeah, so Europe has closed up to about 2%. Banking stocks seem to be leading the way, and we're seeing even on NASDAQ for the big tech companies, we're seeing those come back. So banks and techs are leading the market this week.
We just crossed 500, actually, 500.95. So the Dow's up 500 points. The NASDAQ is up 143 points. And I'll get the S&P here for you in a second. Steve, are you looking at the same numbers I'm looking at?
Mm-hmm. Up 51 points for the S&P.
51. Is there a certain sector, guys, that is driving this, or is it overall? What's going on here?
Yeah, it seems to really be about banks coming back. I don't know. I think it might have been J.P. Morgan Chase was doing particularly well. There were a couple of others that are starting to pop up. And there's no real explanation for why today, why banks, except that, you know, the business case on, you know, due to coronavirus hasn't changed much, so that isn't really driving a lot of things, but we are seeing some more activity pick up, I guess, is one way of doing it. And we're also seeing some other things, like, for example, United and the pilots have reached a deal on schedule reductions to avoid more furloughs, so that was some good news. And on the tech side, we're seeing some bigger numbers in terms of profit and revenue. So all of that, and who knows?
Well, Steve, I meant to ask you a question. I sort of set it up and then didn't get around to it earlier on the show today.
Yeah.
But Steve always reports on the FANG, or FANGs, and I've only recently heard that acronym bandied about. Is that your own creation, Steve, or does everybody use that?
No, let's take a trip back to 2013.
Seriously?
And, Jim Cramer on CNBC came up with that acronym for Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google.
And there's two A's in it, right? Apple, F-A-A-N-G?
Yeah, well, now, and since then, another A has been added.
I see.
And, of course, the G for Google is now, its company name is Alphabet, so that's kind of screwed things up a little bit. But still, so it's F-A-A-N-G/A.
And I guess the point is, guys, that as goes the FANGs, so goes the market these days. Is that fairly true?
Yeah, they're the most prominent of the tech stocks on a regular basis, I'd say. Is that right, Elise?
Yes, they absolutely are huge companies. When you look at an S&P 500, all of those companies are at the top of the S&P 500. I think it's a fight to the day on whether Apple or Microsoft or any of them, really, Google, are the most valuable companies in the world. But they're certainly among the most valuable companies in the United States, and so they would be at the top of the S&P 500. They're also on NASDAQ, most of them, if not all of them. And so they push the NASDAQ up to highs. Now, I think, Steve, remind me, but I think that the NASDAQ actually topped out a little over 12,000, and right now it's a little above 11,000. Mm-hmm. But this is close enough when most of us remember March 9th of 2009, when the NASDAQ was, I mean, really low and had dropped below, I think it was, I want to even say, I don't know, 1,000 at that point. So there's just been a tremendous growth because of these tech stocks.
Makes you wonder what it would be like. And the tech stocks seem to be benefiting from COVID. I wonder what the world would be like, what the job market would be like, what the stock markets would be like if there were no COVID, so the FANGs weren't so elevated, but everything else wasn't so distressed. I wonder if we'd be in about the same place, or would we be higher or lower? I don't know that anybody can answer that, but I'm kind of curious what the world would be like but for this, because without the FANGs, maybe we aren't where we are on the Dow and all of these other indices. maybe our retirement plans aren't as healthy as they weirdly are.
It's a little bit hard to posit, you know, whether you would be at Dow 30,000 versus where we, sooner than we would have been. You also could have had some other sort of recession kick in because recessions do come and go. Business cycles come and go. But what we're seeing in the market over the last few weeks is more confidence in terms of deal making, some more deals.
Hold on 1 second. You're starting to cut out, and I need to take a break. Elise, let me make sure that your line is good. Elise Glink is joining us from ThinkLink Media. We last week told you to go to the Garfield Park Conservatory. They were open. Brenda and I heard about that. Brenda was listening. When I got home, she goes, hey, let's do that. That sounds like fun. So we did. And here's the funny thing that happens. If you say you got to make reservations on the radio, everybody makes reservations on the radio. So we went online to do it. All of the slots for the Monet Garden were full on Saturday. We were in the last slot on Sunday. It's $5, and it's money well spent. And I'm personally telling you that we had a lovely time, and you've got a lot of nice, maybe not over the next 24 hours, but you've got a lot of nice, warm, maybe even cool, dry days here in September and early October. So take advantage of that and support what they do over there at the Garfield Park Conservatory. Elise, have you been over there? Have you done that before?
I have not seen the Monet Garden, but I have been to Garfield Park. It's lovely.
Yeah. And by the way, you don't go inside the conservatory. That's closed up now. But that lawn they have is ginormous. And I've always gone in the wintertime as a break from the cold. I've never actually done the outside part of Garfield Park Conservatory. It's a lovely stroll. You can bring a picnic lunch. You can bring a beverage. You can just sit out there and socially distanced by the acre on that lawn. So if you're looking for a place to get away from it all, that's my recommendation. I'm looking, by the way, just Elise Glink is joining us for a few more minutes. I wanted to talk just a tiny bit more about the stock market. I did see this on CNBC.com. Jeremy Siegel told CNBC he sees multiple factors that are likely to push the stock market even higher next year, regardless of the outcome of November's election between Trump and Joe Biden. I'm surprised to hear that. My guess is if Trump won, it would be status quo and things would stay the same. If Biden won, it would go down. He's not saying that.
No. So a lot of what has propelled the stock market is basically unlimited access to capital. The Federal Reserve has turned on the spigot. They started this process 10 years ago in the Great Recession, and that's really where we saw the stock market start to take off like wildfire. And that's going to continue because the Federal Reserve has basically said we are going to provide an unlimited amount of money to help big companies borrow, and what they're hoping is, of course, that's going to translate into jobs for people, and that's going to translate into other opportunities for development. And it's going to bring, you know, great wealth everywhere down the line. And that sort of thinking is what 9 years after the Great Recession, so 2018 and 2019, propelled unemployment to near historic lows. That's where we were in January and February, right before this all hit. We were basically at a little over 3% unemployment in this country, which was almost at a historic low. And so that's the hope behind this pushing of the cash out there. We're going to get cash out, and hopefully businesses that are going to use it, they'll stay open, they'll stay in business, consumers will return, and we're going to get through this problem of COVID. And meanwhile, the stock market will reflect that with increased sales and profits and revenue, and that's the stuff the stock market's supposed to measure.
A lot of articles like this morning because I guess the world figures that people aren't going to read the entirety of the New York Times reporting on the president's taxes. So you see headlines like 18 revelations from Trump's tax records or what you need to know about Trump's tax records. Do you have any observations about the New York Times spread?
I read all of it last night. I was impressed, I just have to say, by the depth of the reporting and certainly how they dug deep into it. I would love to know who their accounting experts are, because one thing that didn't get talked about a lot is the depreciation that all real estate owners are entitled to. Commercial real estate, not the homes we live in, but these are investment properties. And owners of investment properties are now allowed to take very, very steep deductions. And I would bet, you know, donuts for dollars, that if you looked at the tax returns of the largest commercial property owners in the United States, you would find that because of the depreciation they're allowed to take over more than 37 or 39 years, they get to literally take off as a credit the amount that they paid for the property. And they can depreciate that all the way down to zero, and it literally takes their tax bill down by a fairly equal amount. And so between those, that revenue that you're allowed to, or sorry, I should say that depreciation that you're allowed to take, but also his actual money losing companies. You know, the companies have lost millions and millions of dollars, and because he took those personally, he can also offset whatever income he does have. Those two things seem to account for the fact that the president has paid, according to the New York Times, no federal income tax in 11 of 18 years.
And because he took it personally, he's also on the hook for $420 million in loans which are coming due in the next 4 years. And he has a $73 million disagreement with the IRS, which has been going on since 2008, about the deductions that he has been enjoying.
I wouldn't want those bills.
Oh, man. And yet, because he or his people know how to use the tax code to the nth degree, and there's some discussion to be had about are they doing it ethically or legally, but because they are clever enough, they have so far, it appears, been able to escape the worst of sort of these economic straits that he faces. One takeaway for me was, wow, are the rules written to favor people who have a lot of money and put a lot of capital on the line, as it should be, right? That's the way the economy works. You try and support the people that are creating jobs and running businesses. But when you read the Times report about that, you can't help but scratch your head and think, I wonder if we haven't gone a little far with that. Yes, we need to support them, but shouldn't there be some consequences? Shouldn't they be paying some taxes? And maybe Donald Trump ultimately will lose, say, this argument he's having with the IRS. You know, you do want it to favor businesses so they can be profitable and even allow them some forgiveness so they're willing to take risk. But in this case, it seems as though the tables are turned too much in their favor.
I think that there's a lot of complaining that goes on in certain quarters of business about how much taxes are being raised and how much taxes are paying. But again, I would be willing to bet, because these people have large businesses, because they have very smart accountants, you know, it's a little bit like Warren Buffett said, that he pays a lower rate of tax than his secretary does. And that's wrong. And we need to be able to afford the things that make business possible in this country: a well-educated workforce. We need to have roads so their trucks can go and deliver the things that they're making. We need to be able to keep people employed at a level where they can afford their lives, food and healthcare and other things like that. And all of that together makes a society run. What doesn't make a society run is when you have a whole bunch of billionaires and then everybody else can't even feed their families. And sadly, with the pandemic, it has kind of ripped open the Band-Aid, where we've seen people in the bottom two-thirds of the economy who are suffering tremendously because they don't have the resources and the wherewithal and the smart accountants and even just the income. And so, yeah, you know, you want to make sure that everybody's got a fair shake in this country.
Ironically, the day before I read the Times article about that, I get my ballot in the mail and it says, should we have a graduated income tax in Illinois, which would be fair because then the rich people would have to pay more. And I'm thinking, not all of them are. It's 12:28, and we'll leave it there for now, Elise. It's good to talk to you.
Sure.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, John.
Elise Glink, thinkglink.com is her website, and the title of her book, if you don't have it yet, is 100 Questions Every First-Time Home Buyer Should Ask. Dow continues to trade over 500 points, 172-plus at the NASDAQ. S&P is up 56 points right now. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. We're going next to Greg McBride. Greg is on line number, I just want to make sure I get the buttons right, on line number 7, Senior Vice President, Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com. Greg, thanks for joining us. You're on the air. How are you?
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about this survey you all are reporting on what the priorities are financially for Americans these days. What jumps out in the latest reporting?
Well, it really speaks volumes. You know, in years past, we typically see one of the top priority is, you know, people saying that they're just trying to stay current or get caught up on the bills. But things like saving more money and paying down debt kind of run a pretty close second and third to that. And this year, you know, what we see instead, nearly half of Americans pointed to just staying current or getting caught up on the bills as their top financial priority. Savings was a very distant second. We saw a real drop off in terms of the prioritization of paying down debt. So with about three out of four American households kind of circling around either the just getting caught up and staying current on the bills or saving more money, both of which, you know, very symptomatic of what we've seen economically as a result of the pandemic.
I guess, yeah, you can't be surprised. People, if their income is gone, then we know what American saving rates are like. It's hard to pay your mortgage, right?
And I think there's a pretty strong correlation between this 46% that say that their top priority is just staying current or getting caught up on the bills. And the fact that in a separate survey a couple of months ago, which you and I had talked about on the air at the time, nearly half of households, 49%, said they'd seen their income go down at some point since the outbreak of the pandemic. So, yes, if the income goes away or is just reduced, it makes that budget that much tighter and, you know, really, you know, can take what may have had a budget that may have had a little bit of breathing room and room to save into one where you really got to circle the wagons around just staying current on all the bills.
Congress hasn't done anything on a second round to help people with this, have they?
No, they haven't. And, you know, not only does that, you know, have a household implication in terms of, you know, people really just, you know, not knowing if they're going to have enough to keep, you know, the lights on, you know, to, you know, keep gas in the car. There's a broader economic implication there too, because, you know, that hesitancy among consumers, tends to lead them to cut back on spending. More than 2/3 of our economic output is tied to consumer spending. So one of the reasons we've seen a pretty robust recovery as things opened up back in June, July was because people had money to spend. Without that money to spend, there's a lot of concern that what do we see in terms of the recovery? Does it tail off? Does the jobs recovery, does that tail off? A lot of uncertainties, and a lot of that ties back to the fact that, you know, you're right, Congress, you know, hasn't renewed some of those provisions that previously expired.
I'll ask you to belabor the obvious then. You're right. If I don't get money because I didn't get an unemployment supplement or another stimulus round in my job is either distressed or it's not there. Not only does that impact me, now I don't have money to spend at Target. Now I don't have money to spend on a new car. So if it hasn't caught up, you know, with that generation of the problem, it certainly will, right?
One person's spending is another person's income. And, you know, it's a little like, you know, knocking over a line of dominoes. You take one of those dominoes out and all of a sudden, you know, every domino after that is not knocked over. You know, I think in, you know, again, that, you know, the more people that see a reduction in income, or, you know, they lose a job, a temporary job loss because of permanent job loss, you know, that has a lot of disruptive effects, not only in their household, but that lack of spending that then takes place affects the income, you know, downstream for other households as well.
Bankrate.com's Greg McBride's on a phone line. The headline of one of their stories is nearly half of Americans say their top financial priority is getting caught up or staying current on bills. Did you see it broken down demographically by income or age? Is it across the board, these findings?
Yeah, we did. We, you know, no matter how we looked at it, whether it was, you know, age, income, what part of the country you live in, the top answer was this idea of just staying current or getting caught up on the bills. And that includes even the highest income households. This was their number one priority. The one thing that really jumped out at me, is that half of baby boomers pointed to this as their top concern. And that was by more than a 2-to-1 margin over anything else. You know, that just, you know, I think that sends up a bit of a warning flag, of course, you know, what we saw after the Great Recession was that it was those in the 50 plus age bracket that were most affected by long-term unemployment and trouble getting reemployed. You know, I think this is a warning sign that, you know, there may be some early indications of distress among boomer households, those that should be gearing up for retirement instead. You know, finding it difficult to, you know, sustain their income in the workforce.
I know it's interesting because while they maybe they've lost income, maybe it's hard to sustain the income. The Dow's up 520 points right now. The markets have been, you know, oblivious to all of this talk lately. If you have some sort of 401k or pension that's invested in these stocks, you're probably feeling good about that, right?
That's one positive. You know, yes, the market has rebounded mightily. So those that had the fortitude to hang on in March when we saw that tremendous downdraft, and even those that had the discipline to buy more, they've been rewarded for that discipline and for that patience, because the market has bounced back. The markets are forward-looking, you know, so it's not necessarily reacting on what's the unemployment rate today as much as what are the expectations 6 months, a year, 2 years down the road. That being said, we've seen some volatility over the last month that I expect is going to continue at least through the election because there's so much uncertainty. Uncertainty about whether Congress is going to act to, you know, put some more money in consumers' pockets, those that have of distressed households in particular. Uncertainty about the election, certainly. And then about the virus itself. So, you know, I think, you know, a lot of those unanswered questions are going to lead to a lot of this choppiness, a lot of these ups and downs in the market.
What's the easiest for them to do? Another round of, say, $1,200 per person or some version of that stimulus or an unemployment supplement? The president patched together that FEMA money, but plenty of our listeners have already gotten the last of that they're going to get, and we were kind of late to the game. What would be the easiest thing for them to do, the Congress, that is?
Well, yeah, easiest, I'd like to reframe that as what would be most effective.
Yeah.
And most effective would be something targeted toward households that are not only those that are unemployed, but those that are working but making a whole lot less money than they had been pre-pandemic. And, you know, together, that's more than 40% of households right there. So some sort of income replacement for those that have been most drastically affected by this, I think that goes a long way to sustaining spending and really, you know, giving the economic recovery a boost.
Senator Durbin was on with us a little while ago. Shame on me for not yelling at him. I think every member of Congress deserves, you know, a little lip from all of us saying, I don't care what your party is or what your politics are. People are suffering. And listen to what Greg just said. You need to keep the money flowing. And they're absolutely not doing it, and it's amazing to many of us that they have not been more mobile about this. All right, that's the end of my speech.
Yeah, well, at least they got their recess in August, right?
I mean, you know, it's... Hooray. Greg and you know, and then they come home. But wait, they don't come home to angry meetings because of COVID. So I don't think they've heard the full froth of us, and I think they need to. Greg McBride is the Senior Vice President, Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com. We'll talk again, Greg. Thanks for your time.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
12:43 on WGM. More business news now. Here is Steve Ruxton.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago-based Boeing Company is thinning its core of vice presidents and cutting real estate holdings. The move is designed to counter plunging aircraft sales and mounting costs for the grounded 737 MAX. Two historic Chicago businesses have closed their doors due to the pandemic's effect on business. Lakeview's Southport Lanes opened all the way back in 1922 and was still using human pin setters until earlier this year. And Oakland's Cupid Candies also closed on Saturday. The iconic candy store has been a staple in the neighborhood for 64 years. The Chicago Tribune reporting a $3 billion modernization project of Lakeshore Drive is aimed at improving shoreline protection along Lake Michigan and will also address traffic issues. The comment period for public input on different proposals started today and lasts until November 9th. I'm Steve Ruxton, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Halloween's right around the corner. A lot of conversation these days about how kids will celebrate and play on October 31st. And there's some conversation, too, about how adults are planning on that. Replay Lincoln Park's owner is Mark Kwiatkowski, and he joins us on WGN. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
tell us what you guys do. What's Replay Lincoln Park?
So we're a 10,000 square foot arcade bar normally. So we have 60 plus free vintage arcade games, pinball machines, air hockey, skee ball, and more. And obviously, because of the pandemic, people really can't be inside and don't really want to be playing arcade games and touching things that other people touch. So we have been closed on the inside for the most part since you know, early March.
I want to talk about what you're planning on doing next, but have you been able to do anything then since then, or have you been completely without revenue?
Well, no. So then the city did the, you know, the dining out kind of opportunities and made it easier for businesses like mine to do outside offerings. And we, early August, we got licensed for a sidewalk cafe, and we partnered up with a neighbor restaurant that has also had a difficult time, and we did a Bob's Burger pop-up that ran for 6 weeks that ended actually yesterday, and then we're transitioning that this week to a Stranger Things Patio Plus pop-up. So we've been able to create some revenue and employ a decent amount of our workers, bring them back off of furlough since early August, and then I guess we're going to talk about our other opportunity that we're launching this Friday.
Yeah. So the Bob's Burger thing went well, though, huh?
Yeah, it went really, really well. People loved it, and, you know, it was a great opportunity for the people to be outside, be safe, enjoy some good food, some, you know, good photo opportunities. Like we create a lot of Instagrammable kind of photo opportunities,
right,
that the young people often want.
Yeah. Well, if you have an Instagrammable photo spot, you can almost print the money, at least for that one spot, right? That is such an important and clever twist, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. That's what the young people want, and we give it to them.
So now you've got a drive-through haunted house. Is that the next plan?
That one was a bit serendipitous. The city, when I was trying to get outside opportunities licensed, I was looking to license a big parking lot that's adjacent to the building that my space is in, and we went through the process, and then ultimately the city deemed, after a few weeks of review, that it was too far from the licensed premises. So then they asked me, are there any other, you know, basically parking lots adjacent to your building? And I said, well, there's a loading dock in the alley behind my building that's immediately adjacent to the licensed premises. They said, well, why don't you go ahead and get that licensed? I said, all right, I'll get it licensed. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but, you know, I'll keep it in my back pocket. And lo and behold, I was scrolling, got an alert on my phone, and CNN said something about a drive-in or drive-through haunted experience in Tokyo. And I looked at it, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is something that we can do here.
Yeah.
And I knew that, you know, the haunted houses in Chicago create incredible demand, but this year things are a lot different. A lot of them aren't even opening or are opening on a much more limited scale as far as, you know, how many haunt actors they have and how many people
right.
can be in the haunt at
right,
one time.
Mark, I have 30 seconds left. Tell me, when I drive through in my car, what's going to scare me? How do you do that?
We park. We park six cars, and we have a movie playing on a. So it's like a drive-in movie experience, kind of sets the narrative. And then we have, you know, lots of fake blood, haunt actors playing, you know, demons and the undead and zombies, and and you can't get out of your car. So windows are shut. You can't get out of your car. We have music piped in through the radio transmission, and we will scare you, and you can't leave, so I think that makes it all the more terrifying.
ReplayLincolnPark.com, ReplayLincolnPark.com. I'll catch up with you later. We'll talk more about it down the road. Good luck, Mark.
Thanks, John.
What a good idea.